Thank you, Bob. I join Bob in welcoming you all to the first of the of our programs for this season. I should mention that I'm particularly grateful for people coming out in this kind of weather, and we're running a high-quality simulcast into another room because we were oversubscribed for tonight. So tonight is a very special occasion. We have three guests who are going to behave as a panel and going to show you some terrific slides. Let me begin by referring to the slides, as some of you saw coming in, and if you have a chance after the talk or in the days and weeks ahead, come back and look in the exhibition gallery, where you will see some of these extraordinary photographs jumped up to about triple in size and gorgeously mounted on the walls of the Haas Exhibition Gallery. It's really worth a visit. We have three people with us tonight. Peter Woodall, who's sitting in the middle, is the founding co-editor of the Hidden City Daily and a former newspaper reporter and producer for public radio. He is the project director for Hidden City Philadelphia. To his right, Athenaeum writer in residence, the first writer in residence at the Athenaeum, Nathaniel Popkin, who the other founding editor of Hidden City and the author of nonfiction works Song of the City and the Possible City, as well as two novels and the forthcoming anthology Who Will Speak for America. He's the writer of the documentary film series Philadelphia, the Great Experiment, the best history series on Philadelphia ever put together. Andrew Ferret, who will moderate the discussion with Peter and Nathaniel, leads the filmmaking team at History Making Productions, who are the producers of Philadelphia, the Great Experiment. And he joined History Making Productions in 2008, and in 2013 became director and co-writer of the Great Experiment series. He also produced or created or wrote, I'm not positive, his documentary, Before Hollywood, Philadelphia and the Birth of the Movies, premiered at the Philadelphia Film Festival, and make a note, will be broadcast on 6ABC on Sunday, March 4th at 3:30. It's a terrific documentary. I have seen it twice. So without any more introductory remarks, let me turn it over to this panel.
Oh, to Peter.
To Nathaniel.
Yeah. We got to get rid of this thing on the screen here. There we go. Okay. What do I do with this? Well, this is amazing. It is probably the most disgusting day outside in which is better? Is that better? That's better. Okay. Maybe I'll turn this off and we'll worry about that later. So I'm really so grateful that so many people were able to come out tonight. I don't think anyone wanted to leave their office or their house, and so that you did to be with us here in the Athenaeum is really remarkable. I have to say some thank yous. So thank you to Bob, whose leadership of the Athenaeum is truly showing in the way this institution continues to reassert itself in the Philadelphia landscape. To Peter Kahn, who directs the place, thank you, Peter, for including me or making me writer in residence, the inaugural writer in residence of the Athenaeum, and for helping to organize this event tonight. Bruce Laverty has been such a great and important friend of Hidden City over the years, and making so much of what we do possible through the collection that he manages and through his knowledge and understanding of the city. Mike Seneca, thank you for making all this come together, and the whole rest of the staff of the Athenaeum. So this is particularly wonderful moment right now because to present this book here tonight, it was written in large measure in this room. So there's something really remarkable and special about that for me. As Peter noted, also tonight we are inaugurating the exhibition of not all the photographs from the book, maybe about 50? There's more than a dozen. All right, so about 25. I think, let's say 20. So I would say about 20 of the photographs of Joseph Eliot's photographs from... Exactly 29. There we go. Thank you, Bruce. Are on display, and it is a remarkable exhibition because it putting all of those photographs together in one place like that without having to leaf through the book gives you a sense of the depth of the inquiry that we've sought in this project. So we're going to... been talking about our book quite a lot around the city over the last few months, and we've decided to do something a little bit different for you tonight to make it a little bit more special. So Peter and I are going to talk a little bit about the book. We're going to introduce some of the themes and concepts, and each of us is going to read a short passage just to situate ourselves with the book, what it is and what it is attempting to do. And then Andrew is going to lead us in a discussion for the balance of the night. So that's what we have planned. Let's see now. Whoa, it switched slides all by itself. All right. But with perfect timing. So it's always useful for us to start with this photograph. Some of you know what it is of. It's the Metropolitan Opera House at Broad, North Broad and Poplar Streets. And in many, many ways, this photograph has become sort of iconic for Hidden City, which began with the festival in 2009, and this was a site that was part of that festival. And it is, in certain sense, the seed of what we're doing with this book. And I want to say two things to help us think about this photograph and then begin the evening. The first is that it is a photograph of the city in the present day, and that this book is an attempt to understand, observe, and place Philadelphia in certain kinds of ways in the present day. It is not a history book, but it is a book about the present in tension with the past and with the future. And we like to talk about this photograph and interpret it a little bit. So the blue tarp is not a protective blue tarp that's there for to protect a space from decomposition or anything like that. It's actually the ceiling of the church that kept that space going for a couple of decades long. So in that is a picture of the Metropolitan Opera House in 2009, as it was as a church in that space below there. Here you have one of the most ornate opera houses in America, built at the turn of the century. And so it is obviously in tension with the incredible past that is very slowly decomposing. But it is also, of course, in tension with the possible city, the city of the future, the city that might be. And we now know that in probably within this calendar year, the Metropolitan Opera House's restoration will be complete and will be reopened as a music venue. So, in that present-day space, in that raw material, is the city of the future. And that's the way we conceive of thinking about the hidden city. But I want to say one more thing. So the Metropolitan Opera House was built at the turn of the century by Oscar Hammerstein Sr. It did not last as an opera house for very long, or as his opera house for very long, just a few years. And while it maintained a role as a theater for a very long time, it went out of business very, very quickly. And all that is to say that the Opera House, like many, many dozens and perhaps, well, certainly hundreds of monumental buildings of all kinds, were built in this city during its long 19th century. And that during that long 19th century, Philadelphia was one of the richest and most productive places in the world. That city produced so much material culture, places like the Met, that by the time of deindustrialization and decline of the 20th century, there was so much of it. We were wealthy enough to produce so much of that material culture. And in the late 20th century, we were too poor to erase it. And that situation, that set of circumstances, has sort of left us with the material culture of what we call the hidden city, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
Right. So I run an organization called Hidden City Philadelphia, and it came out of a festival that was held in 2009 that opened up the Metropolitan Opera House and eight other locations around Philadelphia, places that were inaccessible to the public, that were vacant, were obscure, and commissioned artwork, performance work for those spaces. We did it again in 2013, and, you know, looking back, you know, we always say that we didn't think it was an accident that the Hidden City Festival happened here in Philadelphia and not in Boston or Chicago or, God help us, in Minneapolis or Phoenix. So we always felt that there was something hidden about Philadelphia, that it had more secrets than other cities, that certain remnants of the past seemed to survive more frequently here than they do elsewhere. And as Nathaniel said, for us, you know, in my own personal experience, that hidden character was a byproduct of the way wealth was followed by poverty. You know, how else can you explain how a massive building like the Metropolitan Opera House, it's on our busiest thoroughfare, it's on Broad and Poplar, and yet over the decades, so much of its exterior decoration had been stripped away that it really looked like little more than a strange-looking warehouse by the time this picture was taken. And of course, why would you be interested in it? It was the home of a obscure and quite tiny congregation that no one knew much about. And so Philadelphia was filled with these kind of places, we thought. But then, you know, we began to research the book and we found lots of other reasons why Philadelphia was hidden. Certainly, some of it is, we think, due to how Philadelphia remembers the past, the way that the colonial history has sort of monopolized the way that we're thought of, the way that Philadelphia is thought of nationally. And it's come at the expense of other histories. In particular, to me, our industrial history, our legacy as the workshop of the world. But we found that Philadelphia's hidden character, there was a whole nother discussion about its hidden character that had occurred largely before World War II. And our guide for this other conception of why Philadelphia was hidden was an author, a stalwart member of the Athenaeum, and his name was Nathaniel Burt. Many of you are probably familiar with his book, The Perennial Philadelphians. It's one of my all-time favorites, certainly in the top five. And that was our guidebook to understanding this other conception of Philadelphia as a hidden place. And Burt was really talking about, in particular, what he called Philadelphia's hereditary aristocracy. These are the old Philadelphia families that are still with us today, or perhaps even still with us in this room today. Biddles, Marcuse, Morrises, Whartons, Ingersolls, and so on. And so the Burt actually called Philadelphia the hidden city in one part of the book. Yeah, And there was one particular quote that seemed to sum up much of the way he thought about Philadelphia and why it seemed like a hidden place. Burt wrote, "It was neither exciting like Manhattan, quaint like Boston, nor picturesque and glamorous like the South and the West. It was not even conspicuously awful like the Midwest." Yeah, he was a lively writer, Nathaniel Burt was. It was, in fact, like some forbidden Oriental city surrounded by its own impenetrable wall. And that wall was not just a metaphor, it was a real wall. It was the Chinese Wall. Many of you certainly remember it. Pennsylvania Railroad went down what's today JFK Boulevard down to Broad Street Station. But that wall he was talking about, it was social as well. The hereditary aristocracy, what they considered their kind of people, pretty much ended north of Market Street or north of JFK. Sometimes, you know, reading Burt, I think that might have been an exaggeration. And then other times when I think about the history of the Metropolitan Opera House, which was in part its failure was due to those old families' unwillingness to go up to Poplar Street, sometimes I think maybe it wasn't exaggerated. So, I'm going to read a little bit from our book. And I should say, what is this mysterious image here? It's court tennis. Yeah, I certainly didn't. And I grew up in Philadelphia, and I walked down 16th Street past the Racquet Club probably hundreds, if not thousands of times without the slightest idea of what was inside, including court tennis. So, Burt, Princeton class of 1936, attributed the, quote, "disreputable, snaggle-toothed obsolescence of so much of Philadelphia's real estate," unquote, in the early 1960s, to the negligence of its upper class, quote, "shielded from the sight of what their absence has done to their fortunes." Yet what managed to survive from 1916 to 1966 to 2016 often did so in part because the people who gave the firms or institutions or social clubs life, they didn't entirely abandon the city when they moved to the suburbs, but rather they pursued what a Philadelphia blogger, Patrick Hildebrandt, he calls it the long goodbye. So they kept those institutions alive, if barely, by returning to the Racquet Club for court tennis tournaments, to their parish churches on Sunday mornings, and even to their dwindling factories in North Philadelphia during the work week. Mind you, these aren't the same people. Unwilling to relinquish the bonds of family, memory, and identity, they constituted an uncoordinated, unintentional force for preservation through inertia. While the financier Stephen Girard and the scientist William Wagner kept the past alive from beyond the grave through detailed wills and mountainous endowments, the 5th century owners of John Stortz & Son, Inc. kept their tool factory in Old City alive on a kind of remote-controlled life support. As far back as the mid-1940s, the journalist John Gunther wrote in Inside USA that, quote, "Philadelphia retains some remarkable atavisms." The city's glassed-in air was, in a way, it was stifling, but at the same time, it seemed to slow the process of decay. Thus, in Burt's time and still today, a half century later, quaint survivors from an earlier age endure. A patinated, parallel universe of social clubs, rowing clubs, singing societies, drama clubs, military troops, workshops, and athletic associations. This is our good fortune. These institutions deepen and enrich our urban experience by drawing the past into the present. Members of the Racquet Club, still among the economic and social elite of Philadelphia, play two archaic sports, court tennis and rackets. Thank you.
So if we think about the two concepts, the city rich enough to build all this stuff, but too poor to wipe it out, the city of the long goodbye, we begin to understand that Philadelphia changes differently from other American cities. If we go back 100 years, as Pete did in the reading that he just gave, to 1918, Philadelphia's population was the very same that it is today. And so, that same 1.5 million people 100 years ago as in 2018. Of course, that flat line masks enormous change, which we all know about and many of us have lived through, of increased population growth and then decline. However, it does tell us about a city that changes in a unique fashion, which we call in our book a process of accretion. So unlike New York or Los Angeles, New York, which I think doubled in size from 4 million to 8 million in those 100 years, or Los Angeles, or Chicago, which was destroyed by fire and had to rebuild, or San Francisco, which was destroyed by earthquake and had to rebuild, we've never experienced that kind of explosive growth or catastrophic change. And so the nature of Philadelphia is to grow and change and evolve through accretion. And you can walk around, you can walk up Walnut Street, and you can see that as the buildings run up against each other in a particular fashion that takes a long time to see and understand. And hopefully what we're doing with our book is beginning to help that process of reading the city, almost as if it were a book. I'm going to read a passage, and then Andrew will get us started with our discussion. So, see if I can find it. Joseph Eliot's, Joseph Eliot's photographs reframe the view to enable the reader to see farther, deeper, and more clearly. And that's our hope with this book. But they also suggest that the hidden city is not a singular place of skeletal simplicity. Rather, it is many thousands of places, layered one atop the other, intersecting in complex ways. Look at Joe's exterior view of the Globe Dye Works building on Torresdale Avenue in Frankfurt. That's what you got up there. A man in the present-day city walks past the long exterior wall of a factory built in stages starting in 1867. The complex composition of the streetscape makes the layers plain. Windows cinder-blocked and boarded up as eras changed, red and green paint used to cover over graffiti, the various kinds of bricks installed over many decades, the hand-painted and well-faded, founded 1869, on a steel skeleton peaking almost mysteriously above the roofline, and the iconic Globe Dye Works in neon letters over the circular globe installed in the 20th century, which faces away from the camera there at the upper right and toward the distant Atlantic Ocean and the world beyond. In each of these layers, we sense a different hand, a different intent. Each hand reveals a secret of the hidden city. And yet the composition also protects the secrets. The cinder-blocked exterior and faded sign obscure rather than suggest the new life inside the building. So much is indeed in disguise. The cinder blocks suggest that the mill is vacant, but it is possible by really observing the city to know that scores of old factories with cinder-blocked windows that look abandoned are still in use. This one was until it was adapted for reuse for art production and light manufacturing in 2008. Dozens of artists and craftspeople have transformed the sprawling mill into a contemporary place of production. In this book, we invite readers to seek this hidden city. We argue that the act brings them into direct contact with not only the city that is, but the city that was. The layers are the product of the past, of others' ideas and adaptations. From a material standpoint, we can see and touch what others, long before us, have done and made. This encounter interrupts the dominant progressive nature of time, the incessant forward motion of contemporary life. It begs us to think of the latent past as a kind of frontier for exploration. In Philadelphia, even more than in other American cities, this frontier is, to those who know how to look, at once an unmarked victim of neglect, a legible tableau of urban history, and the raw material of the future. All right? So you want to manage that?
Sure. Can everyone hear me? More or less?
I don't know if it's coming.
Yep.
Hello? Yes, it is. Hi. So I want to get started with this next image, and I don't know if you can really see it that well, but it's a plaque that hangs on the wall of the Racquet Club, and it reflects a certain kind of narrative that we're pretty familiar with, especially this week, regarding Philadelphia's athletic domination of Boston. You can see that in several consecutive years, around 1909, I think, Philadelphia is triumphant over Boston and Baltimore in rackets. And this is a narrative about the city of Philadelphia. And I think that one of the really exciting things about this book is that it plugs into tradition and kind of reinvents the tradition, in a sense, of describing Philadelphia through the lens of a particular attribute. And then filtering characteristics of the city through that attribute. You may remember a book from decades ago that talked about the private city. Philadelphia has been called a Quaker city. It's been referred to as a colonial city, the cradle of liberty. It's been referred to as the workshop of the world. And as collaborators on Philadelphia the Great Experiment, Nathaniel and I have become very familiar with and you know, maybe even a little exhausted with some of these appellations that have been ascribed to Philadelphia. So here we have the hidden city. And it's been a while since we had authors who had such a sensitive eye to observe the city at such a level and extract a thesis about it. And so my first question to you is relevant to the Nathaniel Burt passage that you described. What do you think Burt was talking about when he talked about the hidden city? And how does his lens from the mid-20th century contrast with your lens today in the 21st century?
That's for you.
No, it's also for you.
It's for both of you. And speak in unison if you can.
Yeah. Well, you can talk about how much you missed, right?
Right.
Because we both took something very different from the Burt book. I kind of took Burt at his word. You know, he was talking about the hereditary aristocracy, and that he didn't talk about the rest of the city didn't bother me. That wasn't his brief. But it bothered Nathaniel, and I understand that too.
Yeah. So what Burt does is he maybe the word is conflate, and that's just what standard practice in the 20th century, conflated the life, the qualities and characteristics of the landed aristocracy and those families and organizations that surrounded it and gave it life and meaning with the city itself. And of course, there's the movie The Philadelphia Story that does exactly the same thing, right? So this was not an unusual thing to do. If you look at mid-20th century films of New York, they're often taking place in, you know, penthouse apartments. They're presenting a certain aspect of the city that is meant to reflect a kind of culture that is dominant. And so Nathaniel Burt would have said that the button-down, private, landed and sort of family, you know, European model of aristocracy basis for that society was what mattered about Philadelphia, which is absurd. That when, so my reading was that was absurd, and that was blind, and that had missed dozens of other narratives that we've unfortunately lost and haven't paid enough attention to then or now. And so one of the concepts that we have about the hidden city is that there some of what's hidden, like we can use this conceit in different ways to understand the city more deeply and so more comprehensively. And so one of those ways of understanding the hidden city is to think of all of the hidden narratives that are buried in the layers of the city as those layers accumulate, or as certain things do wipe them out. So, Andrew, you mentioned the colonial city, right? This hegemony of the colonial city that came in with guns blaring starting in the 1920s and said, this is what Philadelphia is all about. And it wiped out what the city actually really was, which was a massive, smoky, loud center of invention and industry and immigration. And that's one thing we talk about. Another hidden narrative of the city is its public commercial life that was worn away by deindustrialization. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit more later. And then most particularly is the black narrative of Philadelphia, which Nathaniel Burt, I don't even think, mentioned a single African-American person in his book, or the life of a certain kinds of people. That narrative is also hidden, and we have to search for it, and we have to understand why it's been hidden and how to find it. And that's another thing that we try to do here in this book.
Yeah. I wonder if you might also talk a little bit about how you came to the formulation, The Hidden City. Just some of the nuts and bolts steps in terms of research and just development of this idea and this thesis. And maybe it's fair to talk a little bit also about the organization Hidden City and, you know, where that came from.
Sure. Let's start with the organization.
Yeah.
Hidden City was founded by a gentleman named Thaddeus Squire. He started the organization to create the 2009 Hidden City Festival. And after that festival was over, he helped plan the next festival, but he also allowed Nathaniel and I to start the Hidden City Daily, the website that also explored the city, but in a virtual way. And he moved on to other things. He founded a co-working space and nonprofit, but...
And it turns out the conceit of hiddenness is kind of remarkable for a journalism outlet. So if your purpose is to try to shed light on things, that means they're hidden and we need to find them. So that was the conceit that we used for our web magazine, which we still publish today.
Mm-hmm. So then in terms of the book itself, Temple University Press came to us, it's almost 6 years ago now. And they had seen that, you know, we had an online presence and we had developed an audience. And they said, you know, seems like, you know.
Do you want to see the next one?
Yeah, let's see the next one.
Sorry about that.
You guys, you know, there might be a book you want to write. And we said, sure, a book sounds great. But we had no idea what it was going to be. We kicked around lots of ideas. We thought about, you know, a guidebook, like almost like a travel guidebook to Philadelphia. We thought about a book that would look at some of the more specific architectural elements that we find, the hidden places, but not so much with the photographic element, with Joe's photos.
But then we had Joe's photos, and then we started working with Joe very closely to orchestrate the book. And we began to discover that what he was doing with his photography, and which you can see in the in the gallery downstairs, is to, in a certain sense, x-ray the city. And that is, he goes inside. Most of the photographs in the book are interiors. And so automatically he's exploring that hidden, anything behind the facade is part of that hidden city. Things underground are part of that hidden city. Elemental architectural elements like this water treatment or water filtration chamber in Roxborough is part of that elemental quality of the hidden city, the city that none of us see day by day, but that continues and exists nonetheless. So there's an architectural element to it as well.
Sure, and you know, I should mention that Joe photographed both Hidden City festivals, so we had all the work that he had accumulated from, I think it was 18 or 20 different locations. But then once we had Joe's photos, you know, kind of front and center, we were confronted with a different set of problems. And they were actually just as difficult than figuring out which way to go in the first place. And that is that photo books tend to have pretty standard layouts and ways of organizing themselves. And typically what you'll see is one essay or maybe two essays from someone not really involved with the photographer that talk about his themes or talk about his work. And then in the book itself, maybe there's a little almost encyclopedic bit of information about the place being photographed, when it was built, who was the architect, things like that. Neither of those things seemed to work for us. They seemed too conventional, but at the same time, they weren't really able to convey the ideas that we had, that we had been talking about.
That's right.
One of the great things about the thesis of The Hidden City is this sense that it's not limiting. It's kind of an expansive idea. Some ways of looking at Philadelphia are very rigid, and they will only admit what is included in them, and if something is an outlier, it has to be either ignored or just refuted or something. But The Hidden City actually encourages exploration into other universes within Philadelphia. Are there any other Philadelphias hidden within the broad framework of the Hidden City that you discovered when you were, or found out more about when you were writing this book? Perhaps cities of churches and movie theaters and things like that. Were there any other universes of Philadelphia? Can you talk about those?
Well, the first I would mention goes back to the previous slide, which is that, the kind of how the city works aspect to this. And there's not a lot of that in there, but there is a layer. So the book is broken into two sections. And what Pete was saying is that the text threads through the photographs so that it's in a dynamic tension all the way through the book. And that's what we were hoping to create. The first section is about the way the city collects layers and trying to find all of those layers. And one of them is the infrastructure, whether it be something astounding like this, which sort of boggles the mind, or the remnants of the two great railroads. We can sort of help you see these things within the context of the urban environment. So among those hidden worlds that we do explore is the world of social clubs and associations, which really did create a kind of apparatus of social life and community life in Philadelphia, far differently from our peer cities. So there were in Philadelphia more social clubs and associations than I believe in Boston or New York combined. That might not be exactly right, but it is a stunning figure to think about the way life was organized here. So we explore that as a hidden thing. And another thing, as we said, is both black life, but also civil rights as it appears in different ways through the material landscape of the city, through the properties of the Peace Mission movement of Father Divine, through the Royal Theater on South Street. So there's lots of different ways into that layer.
Yeah. Moving to the next slide, which is going to show the German Society Library. It's little meta. We're looking at a library inside of a library.
Wow.
One of the longest-running tropes about Philadelphia is that the city may have consolidated in 1854, but it never really stopped being a confederation of different towns and villages. That the city has always retained that sort of heterogeneous characteristic. For example, Port Richmond and Germantown are both parts of Philadelphia, certainly, but feel very distinct and different from each other. Perhaps they don't even feel very connected to each other. There isn't a big road or a mass transit line that would make it easy for you to get from one neighborhood to the other. And that's true across the city. There are many different neighborhoods in Philadelphia that retain a distinctive character, and they're often fairly small neighborhoods. In New York, you have the five boroughs, and certainly there are many neighborhoods within those boroughs, but they all take on a certain type of identity around being Brooklyn or around being the Bronx. But in Philadelphia, we have just one Philadelphia, but many distinct different parts that aren't super connected to each other. So does your research, your writing, indicate that Philadelphia in some ways is maybe hidden from itself?
Wah, wah.
Whoa. I will say as a side note that your independent municipalities like Germantown and Frankfurt, if you actually look at the dates they were founded, the oldest ones, they've spent, I think it's equal time now, but as you know, equal or longer as independent than they have as part of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, obviously, yeah. You know, ancestral memory only goes so far, but
right.
How else can you explain, you know, something like Germantown Town Hall, which we talk about in the book, which was built not once but twice as a kind of self-identifier for Germantown, as a place separate from the city as a whole.
And both times after 1854, so
yes.
When it never was a town.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to just frame it the same way, but a little bit differently, which is just to say, you know, how does that sort of fractured character of the city help, you know, keep things concealed or keep things hidden from, like, going on the larger stage of Philadelphia or something to that effect?
I think it reinforces the accretive notion of the city. That is, the city that failed to build a subway system and therefore didn't connect itself very well relied on a streetcar, and that streetcar went too damn slow, and that was the pace of life in the city in a certain way. And because I don't want to say totally, because we misunderstand the city if we think it was just a slow city, which it was not at all. And I'm talking about the city that, you know, sort of finished its way out by 1950 and then has been slowly reconfiguring itself since then. So, but I do think that it's an accumulated place. It's mounts on top of each other with only the dominance of Center City, right? So all of the other parts of it kind of are somewhat of an equal plane. And that's an interesting notion. That also might be a warped idea of the city as to today, when industry is, when the industrial economy is gone, we don't read or think or see, say, Kensington or North Philadelphia the way one would have 100 years ago, right? So we're interpreting it differently. And what ends up happening is that cities don't change in uniform ways. I think city planners have this notion that, you know, you can affect change and the whole city is going to change in one way. But a city of 1.5 million people is a city of 1.5 million narratives all colliding in the same space and working itself out in a dynamic form. So there is something about the decentralized nature of Philadelphia that reinforces that and slows it down in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a terrible answer. I don't think we really...
No,
it's, it's a tough one. You know, I mean, going, you know, bringing it up to the present, I was reading a memoir of I think he was a dentist, and he lived up in Olney, and he had his office in Society Hill, and he would walk to work. And I just thought, how could you do that? because, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, there was a lot of neighborhoods in between Olney and Center City that I thought it was not a good idea to walk in. And so I feel like, you know, I've personally been separated from large parts of the city based on my understanding of whether it was safe to go there, even. And I'm sure that's true for many people.
And I would say, first of all, he probably walked because it was faster than the trolley.
Probably was.
And second of all, one of the purposes, the mission of Thaddeus Squire when he created the Hidden City Festival in 2009 was to break that down and to get Philadelphians out of their... And all cities, people in all cities have their comfort zones. People who live in the 5th arrondissement of Paris, they don't go to the other arrondissement. Like, this is a normal thing.
It's totally
So it's not particular to Philadelphia. But the Hidden City Festival is meant to draw you out of your neighborhood and seduce you into going to somewhere else by opening up a space that you'd never seen before and making it even better because of the art that's put in there. So part of what, you know, we're trying to break that down, I think, a little bit. In trying to get around.
Right.
And that's part of the reason why the BERT analysis and my reading came up short is because it did what you said. It stifled the exploration or trapped it into one kind of, one set of people rather than opening it up.
Yeah. There's an anecdote that the book reminds me of. You mentioned memoirs of dentists and like so. One of the best
all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
this.
Right. One of the best ways to think about to learn about Philadelphia is to read these incidental accounts from biographies or memoirs. Mm-hmm. In the biography of W.C. Fields, famous Philadelphian, there's an anecdote that takes place where he grew up, which was around Germantown and Allegheny Avenue in North Philadelphia. And it's an anecdote of criminal mischief from his youth where there was a dry cleaners and the owners of the dry cleaners worked in the back. And the way that they would know someone came into the store was a little bell would ring when he walked in through the door. So Fields and his friends had a scheme where they would try to steal the dry cleaners tickets because if you stole the ticket, you could sell it and then the person could go in there and pick up whatever clothes were attached to that ticket.
Good old days.
The scheme was that they would stand on Germantown Avenue and wait for the trolley to come up Germantown Avenue, and then Fields or one of his cohorts puts his hat on the trolley tracks. So the trolley comes all the way up and stops, and there's a hat on the tracks, which would probably derail it. And so they ring the bell, and that causes enough noise and commotion that someone can sneak in undetected to the dry cleaners. Steal all the tickets and then go sell them. So this story, right, reflects a city with a very bustling, vibrant, active street life, active commercial life, active underground economy, right? It's the 1890s, you know, and it doesn't feel like the somber, you know, drab city of Sundays or whatever people want to call it. So, you know, how does your book sort of illuminate that lost sort of public commercial life in Philadelphia?
You know, I mean, the famous W.C. Fields quote is, the longest year I ever spent was a Sunday in Philadelphia. So, you know, once he got to drinking age,
yeah, right.
Things changed for him, I think.
I guess so.
But certainly, this is the public commercial life that Nathaniel was talking about.
And it's one of the things that deindustrialization did erase, so significantly disfigure that when I came here in the 1980s, it wasn't really very recognizable. You know, in terms of the public commercial life of movie houses, 24-hour cafes, diners, neighborhood clothing stores, union halls, all different kinds of schools that every single one of those avenues all across the city had in droves and was mostly the ecosystem of children, that was worn away and disfigured significantly by the late 20th century. But by not understanding that it was there, We get confused into thinking that Philadelphia was only that city of Sundays when everything was shut down and it was, in essence, the quiet city. And what we're, one of the layers that we try to reveal and peel back is that, and it's visible, you can see it. We have a couple examples of it in our book, of how vital and important that life was, and you can still read it in the streetscape today.
I want to ask you, actually, I don't know if this corresponds directly to commercial life, but it's public life. The photograph up there is of posters from Hawthorne Hall in West Philadelphia.
Yep.
Can you sort of talk a little bit about that photo and what it's showing maybe in relationship to that? I mean, it's basically showing these are artifacts of a place where there people gathered. There was a gathering point for neighborhood and society.
Right. It's sort of, you come to recognize the sort of the typical architectural form of some of these different types of building uses. And for social clubs, a big meeting hall on the second floor, oftentimes with a stage and even a balcony, seems to appear again and again. And Hawthorne Hall had been used by a church for 40 years when this photo was taken, and yet somehow some of this stuff, which probably dates from at least the 50s, was just laying around. It kind of boggles my mind that you know, well, that's something we see all the time when we go into these buildings. Is you'd think people would clean up after themselves. Your company went out of business. And all you do is, you don't even lock the door or turn out the lights. You just hightail it out. It's the darndest thing, and it's a wonderful thing for us because we get to see so much of what gets left behind. But
and in this case, it's a little glimpse of what we might call working class life. And that is, this was a vaudeville hall. They had a theater. It was a union hall, as you can see. They had all kinds of meetings, and that's an aspect of that public commercial life that was incessant. It was going all day and night, particularly around labor or other kinds of activism. On just about every avenue, there were places where people met to try to create solidarity over whatever issue that they could. There were radical libraries, there were training centers, etc. How are we doing?
On the time.
I think we're pretty.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, let's
yeah.
Do it.
I'll do one more question and then we'll open it.
Yep.
Which the last one is just how would you distinguish your approach of looking at the city compared to a historian's approach of looking at it? Because you're certainly talking about historical material, but you are filtering it through a different perceptual lens. That's the John Grass wood turning.
Well, we spend a lot more time peeking in windows, that's for sure. That's how I found out about John Grass. It's right on 2nd Street there. And unless the windows are really dirty, really dirty. And unless you really put your eye to it, you can't see very much. So much of what the way I approach learning about the city starts with walking around and sort of poking into the material part of it, and then going and researching it afterwards, and then going back to the city, and then back to the research, versus someone who's maybe in the books the entire time.
And for me, the city exists as a literary joyride. You know, for me, the ability to stick your hand into this bucket of lives and buildings and things and histories and narratives that are sometimes in conflict with each other, is for me a literary experience, and I try to transform it into literature. That's the way it works for me. So sometimes I get called a historian, which is ridiculous because I've never been trained in history, but for me it's But then I spend time in archives, and this book was written here in this building where there's an extraordinary architectural archive. So There is, it just works backwards in a certain way. It starts with the present day city and the life that we lead and the world that we live in and the things that we see with our own eyes and what interests us as a kind of passion, and we work backwards from there. That's what fuels the Hidden City Daily, our web magazine. It is what fuels this, and what we're looking for, at least I think what I'm looking for often, is the intersection of the physical city and the, what I've come to call the metaphysical city, the place of ideas or culture or religion or elements of history that filter down. And in that intersection is how this is why, I think, this city feels so rich as a subject for a book like this or for all kinds of different works, even films.
Yes. So